Fired up, ain't gonna take it no more. Tied up, ain't gonna take it no more. You say cool down, we say step down. You're breaking my mother's heart. Fired up, ain't gonna take it no more. Tied up, ain't gonna take it no more. You say cool down, we say step down. You're breaking my mother's heart. Shame, shame.
This is a Building Bridges, your Community and Labor Report special. I'm Ken Nash.
And I'm Amy Rosenberg.
While the battle rages on about reform of the AFL-CIO, one reform never mentioned by the AFL-CIO leadership or the coalition led by the Service Employees International Union is union democracy. The battle is about organizing, about workers having a voice at work. But what is never mentioned is that in too many unions, workers have little or no voice. While union presidents debate how the restructuring of unions was the solution to the ever-shrinking labor movement, the idea that a truly democratic unionism, where members are educated about their rights, is the way to build thriving unions, is lost in the shuffle.
But it was not so long ago that Teamsters for a Democratic Union was on the upsurge, and that there were active rank-and-file caucuses in the miners, steel workers union, and construction trades unions, among others. And to assist these movements for democracy and unions, there was and still is the Association for Union Democracy and its past president and founder, Herman Benson, who began his labor activity in 1930. Time hasn't smothered Benson's fire for reform that has been his trademark these many years. In fact, he's just come out with another book, Rebels, Reformers, and Racketeers, How Insurgents Transformed the Labor Movement, and was recently invited to speak about the book by the New York Public Library Guild Local 1930 of District Council 37. And now, Herman Benson.
Can't just focus on the kids with wealth. Can't pick and choose who gets the health care. Take another look at the great divide. Love's dangerously similar to genocide. We're fired up, ain't gonna take it no more. Tied up, ain't gonna take it no more. You say cool down, we say step down. You're breaking my mother's heart.
It's really a great pleasure for me to be here with Local 1930. When I first started working on this book, there were these spectacular events in the AFL-CIO. The group of union leaders got together, forced Lane Kirkland out as president of the AFL-CIO. They were determined to organize the unorganized, make the labor movement a force for social justice in America. After Sweeney came into office, there was a wave of enthusiasm in support of it. So when I wrote this book, Rebels, Reformers, and Insurgents, I gave it the subtitle, How Insurgents Transformed the Labor Movement. Looking back, it was a little bit optimistic. However, it does contain a certain basic truth. The groundwork for the big change in 1995 was prepared by some 35 years of battling in many of the major unions in the United States for democracy and against corruption by insurgents. That story has never been adequately recorded. So I wrote about machinists and painters, steel workers, electricians, and I refer to many of the others. The machinists. While A.J. Hayes was head of the AFL-CIO Ethical Practice Committee, he was using his authoritarian power as president of the International Association of Machinists to work his own personal authoritarian power to order the expulsion of people who were fighting against corruption in the International Association of Machinists. And two reform leaders of the Painters Union were murdered on the order of one of the leading officials of the International Painters Union because they were fighting against corruption that he was deeply involved in. And elections in the Steelworkers Union were stolen wholesale. That led to a powerful insurgent movement led by Ed Sadlowski. In the IBEW Electricians Union, thousands of electricians were fined, suspended, and some expelled illegally for exercising their basic democratic rights. That situation was only changed with the assistance of insurgents in the Electricians Union, and they did such an important job. Why don't you hear about these people? These are big events. These people are heroes of the labor movement. And yet, their story is forgotten. In 1972, there was a big change. The Miners for Democracy succeeded in defeating Tony Boyle, president of the United Mine Workers Union. He was responsible for ordering the murder of the leader of the insurgents, Jock Yablonski. His successors took over the union. They turned it into a reasonably democratic union. Richard Trumka, secretary treasurer of the AFL-CIO, was elevated into that position from president of the United. The reason why he could make that jump is because Jock Yablonski gave his life in order to defeat the murderers who ran the United Mine Workers Union. And when the Miners for Democracy won their battle, there was a big upsurge among insurgents throughout the labor movement, and it was finally climaxed with the rise of the Teamsters for a Democratic Union, a group which has been in existence now as a strong insurgent movement for at least 20-odd years, and they made possible the victory of Ron Carey, the first major defeat for racketeers in the Teamsters Union. But more than that, it was the insurgent movement in the Teamsters Union made possible the victory of Sweeney in 1995. Teamsters for a Democratic Union and Ron Carey changed the balance of power in the AFL-CIO. I say, yes, there was a transformation. First of all, they put union democracy on the agenda, and they legitimized the idea of insurgency in the labor movement. Now, up till then, there were views about union democracy, the familiar hostile view that at a time when the union is under attack from vicious employers and reactionary Republicans, you can split and divide the labor movement by causing trouble and devising by talking about this union democracy. But you don't hear that too much today because, after all, you have Stern has his insurgency. Nobody's calling him yet someone who's trying to destroy the labor movement. Now, 10 years after the big overturn at the top, nothing much has changed. That stalemate has provoked a new confrontation, this debate among the leaders up on top. One of the very important differences is there's been no echo of enthusiasm among any public. This discussion hasn't penetrated into the ranks of the labor movement. I don't know, even in this audience of active, concerned unionists, I wonder how many of us can really know what are the differences here. At this point, the debate has settled into a confrontation between two points of view. One is side led by Andy Stern, the SEIU president. He says we have to concentrate on organizing the unorganized, and for that you have to get rid of John Sweeney, and he even threatens, unless he has his way, to split from the AFL-CIO. And on the other side, the supporters of Sweeney say we have to emphasize the urgent need for political action. But says the Stern group, what good is political action if you don't build up your membership base? Because who will take you seriously in politics if you don't have lots of members? But says the Sweeney group, how do you ever expect to be able to make any massive gains in organizing the unorganized unless you change the political climate in America? And for that, you need a vigorous political action program. So you have, are you going to organize to get political clout, or are you going to try to get political action in order to get organizing clout? That's the difference, that's what it boils down to. And it's almost like the famous dispute between, you know, the chicken and the egg, which is more important. The great debate as it centers around this, it seems to me, it might seem to be pointless. It's not really pointless, of course, because anything that creates a big discussion in the labor movement is progress. It gets us away from this hypocritical unanimity that is supposed to prevail over the whole labor movement. It gets you away from the stuff you still see in most of the union papers. You know, every contract is historically the best contract ever negotiated since the last greatest contract that was ever negotiated. We're marching forward, a victory here and a victory there. We won in the Scheister Manufacturing Company. We won by 90%. They don't say there are only 10 workers, there are 9. So at least there's a discussion, and that's very important. The debate now has reached a dead end, but I am asking you to look at the problems from a different angle. The problem as I see it, I would sum up in this truism or something. How do we make our labor movement a force influential enough to change the balance of power in America? And we're told over and over again that the labor movement is historically in its weakened position. 13% are organized, only 8% in private industry are organized. But even in its weakened position, there are 16 million people organized into the American labor movement. If you add the members of their families, you've got maybe 50 million people who are under some influence of the labor movement. And that's a powerful force. It's no special interest. This is the crossroads of America. It's every profession, it's every race, every creed, every nationality. And the trouble is that the AFL-CIO has not been able to convince a huge section of its own membership to follow its lead. They have this powerful potential force, and the AFL-CIO cannot command the support of a huge section of its own membership. They couldn't get them to follow their lead in the 2004 election. If you just take the white working class, it's almost 50-50, not quite. If you discount the votes of the blacks in the United States, which go overwhelmingly for the Democratic Party, not because they're following the lead or have loyalty to the labor movement, but because their position in society has taught them what they have to do. But the labor movement has not been able to lead a big section of the white working class. Now, how can you solve this problem by organizing more workers when you can't convince that close to half of those you already have? Now, most union members with any normal sense know that the unions are a good thing. They don't have any emotional attachment to them. They look upon unions as any other nice, helpful institution, the Association for Retired People, the American Automobile Association. And the leaders run the unions without respect for the members, with contempt for the members. And this is a problem throughout the labor movement. In large sections of the labor movement, especially in the construction trades, if you criticize your business agent, you do not work and your family suffers and you starve. It's in the American labor movement. They have all kinds of restrictions on the right to run for office. You see it right here in Local 384 in DC 37, where one of the members who wanted to run for office is disqualified because she fell for a moment into lack of good standing because she was arrested in the course of an anti-war demonstration. Now, this is not an unusual, aberrant rule. Throughout the labor movement, they have restrictions like that. They have attendance rules which restrict 97% of the members from running for office. They have a 2-year continuous good standing rule. So if by some accident you forgot, or the financial treasury deliberately forgot to enter it at the right time and you fell a day behind 2 years ago, you can't run for office. And that affects huge sections of the labor movement. To say nothing of, we still have the lack of due process in trials. We have hiring halls which are run in order to establish a political machine for the leaders. The problem is to win over the members to become loyal, enthusiastic supporters of the labor movement. It's not enough to organize the unorganized. We have to unionize the organized. We have to guarantee fair election. Give people the right to run for office. Let them have honest votes on contracts and referendums. Let them elect their shop stewards. Democratize the labor movement, and then it can win the respect of the members and lead them in political life. That, as I see it, is the problem of union democracy, and that's what I try to really write about in this book of mine. When you fight to make this a really good democratic union, you do more than just take care of your own needs for a democratic union. You will be creating a model for the rest of the labor movement that we can point to for the rest to follow. And that will be a contribution not just to yourself but the labor movement at a time when it really needs that kind of democratization.
Ain't gonna take it no more. Tied up, ain't gonna take it no more. You say cool down, we say step down. You're breaking my mother's heart. Shame, shame.
You've been listening to Herman Benson talk about his new book on union democracy, Rebels, Reformers, and Racketeers. And to find out more about union democracy or to order the book, go to the Association for Union Democracy website at www.uniondemocracy.org. www.uniondemocracy.org.
You say cool down, we say step down. You're breaking my mother's heart.
And I'm at the AFL-CIO convention, and the first people that I run into are Gary Huck and Mike Konopacki, Huck Konopacki Cartoons. And for those in the audience who don't know what Huck Konopacki Cartoons are, which one of you wants to tell our audience?
Hi, I'm Mike Konopacki. Gary Huck and I draw political cartoons for labor unions, and we call them labor cartoons. So it's an interesting way of communicating with working people and talking about their issues.
But Gary, I heard an announcement that there's going to be a split in Huck Konopacki Cartoons.
Sadly, that's true. Unfortunately, Mike and I couldn't reconcile our differences. I wanted to merge all our subscribers into one to save postage, and Mike insists on giving all our revenue to the Democratic Party. So we're splitting into two different cartoon syndications, Huck Co. and Onopacki. So look forward to receiving brochures from both of us. Obviously, I'm slanted towards Mike's cartoons, so I suggest you subscribe to Onopacki Cartoons.
Would you like equal time on that?
I think this whole thing is ridiculous. Well, actually, I'm also a member of the IWW, so I do believe in one big union, but I don't know if I believe in one big subscriber.
Who's going to go with Change to Win? Who's going to go with the Federation, and who's going to go with the Romulans?
Romulans look good to me. For example, they dress better than Klingons, and they don't have the weight problem of some of the other labor leaders.
So. I propose a merger with the Romulans, and it would be called the AFL-CIO UFO.
Well, you do have a book here, Two-Headed Space Alien Shrink Labor Movement. Why don't you talk about this new book you've got, Two-Headed Space Aliens in the Labor Movement?
Well, we started our syndication service to the labor press in 1983, and so this book celebrates our 20th year as Huck Konopacki Labor Cartoons, and it can be found on our website at solidarity.com. And when we started this, the labor movement represented 20% of the workforce, and 20 years later, it was down to 13%, and in the last couple of years, it's been down to 12%.
So is that your fault?
We figure that if we keep this up for another 10 years, the labor movement will disappear.
It's all your fault, Gary.
Yes, actually, in the introduction, we talk about doubling our efforts. But I want to say something else about the book. It's the only book of the five books that we publish that have current cartoons. So all the older books have old cartoons. The new book has new cartoons. So if you like new, you really need to get this book. If you're a traditionalist, I suggest you buy one of the other four books.
So let's talk about some of the new cartoons. If you were doing a cartoon right now dealing with the current disagreements, shall I say, in the labor movement, what comes to mind?
Well, actually, because we think of this debate within the labor movement as much caused by outside forces, so I did a cartoon of a giant prison tower, and I have two prisoners a wall away banging on their metal cups. And one of the guards says, "What's that funny noise?" And the other one says, "Oh, it's the labor movement debating its future." And it's basically the prison that they're in is the repressive labor law in this country, which I think has a lot to do with the shrinking of the labor movement. So the direction really means people are trying to, they're struggling with an idea of how to change things so that they can get more people protected by democracy in the workplace.
I have a cartoon I drew that's a caution sign, which is basically the format by which you don't have to think about drawing a cartoon. But the caution sign says labor movement, and then it has arrows pointing in four directions. So if the next one would be the arrows breaking apart, and the next one would be the arrows shooting out in all directions, and the next one would be the arrows going through workers, and the next one would be a bunch of workers impaled on arrows. And so I don't know. It just seems to me that the issues of the day are not who leads the labor movement, because, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought it was the rank and file that led the labor movement. Who's actually sitting as president of the AFL-CIO, whether those numbers, letters all add up or they break apart. What matters is that workers be able to organize in the union and fight for their own rights, which I would hope they would be able, you know, would go about doing regardless of what the makeup of the leadership is.
Do you think that workers are the missing element of this conversation, so to speak, in the labor movement?
Well, we were discussing that over breakfast, talking about where the labor movement actually would come from. and we were discussing the surge in unionization in the early 30s, and that was before the Wagner Act was passed, which is the National Labor Relations Act, which gave people the legal right to join unions. So workers actually forced that law into being. And so really, that's a bottom-up kind of thing, and our hope always is that there will be another resurgence from the bottom. This is kind of a resurgence from the top, and the bottom really has to, working people will lead their own unions when they start demanding that they have those rights. And so the union's job is to try to facilitate that. So the pressure really has to come from the bottom. People have to demand, you know, better conditions at work. And a union is a way to arrive at that, but they also have to demand their right to have a union.
And how do cartoons fit into that whole idea of pressure coming from the bottom?
I want to say something very important.
No.
Well, I was lying. I never say anything very important. But the next issue, even if the split takes place, will be the more important issue of color. So Andy Stern's insistence on purple could very well split the new group. Well, the Teamsters, for example, I never look good in purple. And you know, we brought the farm workers in, and their red and black motif clashes with purple. So I'm saying there's going to be union color wars breaking out all over this country very soon.
And that reference was to the United Farm Workers joining the Change to Win coalition.
Again, I mean, the unions are joining up in different coalitions, but again, you know, the bottom line is that the workers have to start demanding that they be recognized, and they have to kind of take control of some of this stuff as well.
And how does humor help in this process, and how do your... Well, let me get my question out first. I've got to move the mic over to you. How do your cartoons help in the process? Your turn now.
Well, I think we can make fun of ourselves, which I think is really important. I mean, a movement that can make fun of itself is a real vital movement. So we can make jokes about the AFL EIEIO, or but the whole thing is that we do cartoons that sometimes are very indignant and angry, and oftentimes funny and laughing at ourselves. And we do it a lot of times, even though the officers may not like the humor, the workers do. And we consider this as kind of like the Bill Malden School of Labor Cartooning, where he drew cartoons during World War II depicting Willie and Joe, the muddy grunts that were fighting. And the officers didn't like it, but they realized that it was good for morale. And that's kind of what we do. Hopefully we're good for morale for our members and our readers.
All right, let's forget about the split for a second. Why don't you talk just about some of the cartoons you do on the state of the labor movement, if it is a movement. maybe there'll be many movements, or maybe there'll be no movement, but talk about the labor movement generally in terms of the challenges that we face.
Well, I'll remind Gary of a great cartoon that he did of Robert Reich when he was Clinton's Secretary of Labor. And he was a short-statured man. And standing next to him was this little tiny figure labeled Big Labor. And recently in the New Progressive magazine, Barbara Ehrenreich wrote a whole column about how to change tiny labor, because that's basically what we are now. But again, we have to be able to laugh at ourselves, have a little fun at our own expense. And if we do that, we're not giving the bosses, you know, another hammer to hit us over the head with. We're showing them, you know, that we're secure in what we do. And it's part of, like, it's workplace culture, because actually workers do a lot of that themselves. There's a lot of workplace jokes, a lot of, you know, workplace humor that people come up with on their own. Sometimes it's gallows humor. But, you know, so our cartoons just try to reflect some of that stuff.
I want to say that, I mean, if you look at the opposition, basically we read articles after articles of corporations merging, global capital moving in whatever direction it wants, the political structure of this country being dominated by one party and not a worker-friendly party. And then we talk about the labor movement, and it's about how it's coming apart at the seams. These are not unrelated stories. The labor movement's addiction to the Democratic Party is certainly an issue that I don't really see being talked about here. Because my guess, the idea that we're spending too much money supporting the Democrats, one could ask the question, should we be spending any money supporting the Democratic Party until they start acting like a party of labor?
So it seems as if you're both pretty much saying the same thing, but you're still going to be splitting in the near future?
No, actually, I predict a merger. We figure that because the history of the labor movement is also the history of groups coming together, for example, the AFL and the CIO joining forces in the 50s, that in about 20 years, the Change to Win coalition will probably be brought back into the fold, and it will be the AFL-CIO CTW. And then who knows how many more letters will come after that.
Would that only be after the...
You have to include the AFL-CIO UFO CTW. It could get pretty long.
And I'm hoping that we can merge with Carol Simpson. So it would be Huck Simpson, Konopacki, Carol. And we're looking to merge with other cartoons, and we should warn some of them it will be a hostile takeover.
Well, you've heard it here first of Building Bridges. And for those people who are not lucky enough to see your cartoons in their own labor newspaper, I guess they can go to the web?
To solidarity.com and just click on the cartoon and you'll go into the Huck Konopacki website.
I've been talking with Gary Huck and Mike Konopacki, Huck Konopacki Cartoons, which may stay together and may separate and tune in for...
Listen to me when I talk, and you're always going to be...
The Democrats want more money. Give me your wallet.
Come on. Oh, sure. Democrats...
What are they going to do with them? Yeah. They have the working class.
Rumble.
This has been a Building Bridges, your community and labor report special.
You say cool down, we say step down. You break another mother's heart.
Break another heart.